Welcome to another episode of Fair Conversations, part of the Mormon Faircast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about Fair or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of Fair Conversations, and in this episode I'm joined by Stephen Peck. He is an associate professor of biology at Brigham Young University. Stephen joins me to talk about evolution, science, and Latter-day Saint thought. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. I'm joined today by a biologist, writer, and Latter-day Saint, Stephen Peck. He's a professor at Brigham Young University, to talk about faith and science. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Good, Blair. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for coming on the podcast today. And I just want to start out by giving you 2 or 3 minutes here to talk a little bit about your background.
Okay. Probably fairly typical for a Mormon. I served a mission in Arkansas. That was actually after an experience of 3 years in the Army. Came back, went to BYU. I intended to study the humanities, actually, but got sidetracked into biology, which I loved, and then got into a wreck with my wife on our honeymoon with a drunk driver, which made me think very practically. So I got a degree in statistics and then a doctorate in biomathematics, all the while, though, with my eye on ecological and evolutionary processes. Sort of my real interest has been evolution. The way to get there through mathematics happened to be a really good way to do that. So that's what I did. I have 5 kids, 4 sons and a daughter on the end. The 4 sons have all left home. I've got a son on a mission in Finland right now.
Okay, great. And it looks like you've been at BYU for about 11 years now. Before we move on, though, I want to talk about the term science and what we mean when we use that term throughout this discussion.
I actually think a lot about this because I teach history and philosophy of biology. And one of the key questions is, what is science? How do we define it? There's kind of a school kid's notion. The process of science is essentially to find a hypothesis, to test the hypothesis, to reject the hypothesis, and then move on from there. But there's some truth to that. Experimental approaches play a really important part in science, but that's not the whole story. I mean, it's kind of like describing tennis, say, as hitting a ball with a racket. I mean, that's part of tennis, but that really isn't as rich an activity as actual tennis playing describes. And so science basically uses several tools. It uses tools like experimentation, observation, modeling, all of these things come into it. But one of the important things to remember about science is it is a social activity. And it's particular stance to the world, I think, that makes science what it is and what's powerful about it. First, science is always open to revision. It's always testing its claims. I'm kind of personalizing science as if science were a person doing this, but this is really the activity of people engaged in trying to understand the universe. And so scientists challenge each other. They're open to revision. One of the most important things about science is peer review. The way things come through the process of science through formal publications that are criticized and critiqued. And science is a Darwinian process. It's a bloody battle.
Science isn't just something that one person does. You mentioned it's a sort of a community thing. And so in a lot of ways, do you think scientists rely on the testimony of other scientists?
And absolutely. Absolutely. And that's important to keep in mind. It is a social activity. And the same problems that you'd have in any kind of social organization or social group of people. There are biases, there are agendas, there are all kinds of things. What makes science a little bit different, though, is its openness and its refusal to be let things become dogmatic and fixed if there's evidence that suggests otherwise. So peer review, typically, this is the way it proceeds. I write a paper. I use the ex models, experimentation, all the different tools that science uses. I send that, and they send it to people who can critically evaluate that, experts in the field that are credentialed to have the right sorts of background to make a decision about whether this is good or not. They come back with a decision, almost always with revisions that need to be made. This is where you messed up. These are problems with your analysis, with your data gathering. And it's quite literally, it's from 6 to, say, 20% acceptance rate. And once it passes muster, then it's published openly, the data's published openly, and other scientists continue to critique it and to assign its place in sort of the universe of thought.
In the introduction, I mentioned Galileo, and that's sort of an interesting case because the common myth is that Galileo had figured out a new way of viewing the universe, and that he was then rejected by the church, who was, relying on the Bible for their view of things. And have you looked into that story at all to see how that can be better contextualized than that common way that people understand it?
A little bit. I'm not an expert by any means, but you're right. It is a much more complex story and has probably more to do with his disobeying the Pope and making fun of him a bit than just the scientific story. But there is that element that Galileo has become sort of the paradigmatic religion versus
But have
science
there been times when religion has
and
facilitated science?
absolutely. In fact, for most of the Enlightenment, science and religion went hand in hand. In a complex way. Again, the idea of science is trying to investigate the natural world, using the natural world itself to understand that. But religion was not seen as something that was harmful. One way that religion really helped science progress during those years is that the idea of knowledge was important. The idea that we had a rational God, and because we had a rational God, we could discover things about the world through rational processes. And so science is being enamored with sort of rational approaches is actually grounded in the idea that we had a rational God that used natural laws and things that were discoverable by humans. And so the relationship between science and religion has always been complex, partly because both ways of thinking are trying to gain some authority on speaking about the way the universe is.
Right. And a lot of historians have suggested that that's about the time period when this mythology of science versus religion as antagonists has sort of grown up. Some people have looked at Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon is late 1500s, early 1600s. They look at him as one of the important authors of the modern scientific method. And Bacon himself believed
Right.
in God. It might not have, purported with that current Christian view of God in his time, or perhaps with LDS views of God, but nevertheless, he did believe in a God, and he developed this idea of two different books that people can draw on to learn about the world, and one was the book of God's Word, the Bible, and the other was the book of nature, and he saw these two books as things that people could read or could learn about God's purposes by studying. Do you think that that's a still sort of a valid way to look at the issue?
Let me pick at one
Yeah.
point of that first
Sure.
and then comment. The idea that we can pick out God's purposes from nature, I think, is a little problematic in that it assumes that that God's purposes can be read off of nature in ways, and that's led to problems. Now, the idea, though, that you can understand the complete conception of the universe through both, I think, is really, really important. In fact, Elder Scott in 2007, I think, gave a talk on truth. And the first one he talks about as science as a way of learning truth. And then he elaborates on that and talks about what scientists have learned. And so the Book of Nature, and I really like that imagery, actually. the book of nature, I think, is really important to study just to understand truth. And I think there are things that we can learn from nature about God, but not in the way that's been done in the past, where God becomes sort of an explanatory and face an explanatory force in nature in ways that have led to problems and things. But I think that looking at Scripture, Revelation, and the Book of Nature gives us a much more complete view of the nature of the universe and our place in it. And I'd slide our place in it more towards Revelation and Scriptures and less to nature, and that nature that we're embedded in being sort of better understood through science. Not a clean break, but those tendencies tend to be there. We learn much more about who we are and why we're here from religion than we do from science, and conversely, we learn much more about the universe through science than we do through the Scriptures and through Revelation, just because the concern is, what is our relationship with God? And I think that's probably the most important
sort of following
of
up on that is William Paley, who was a natural the idea of natural theology kind of grew up after Francis Bacon,
right.
and you touched on this a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit more about it before we move on. So Paley, he had this idea of the watchmaker, where we can look at the world and see that its complexity and conclude that there's intelligence behind that, or that there's a designer, a watchmaker behind that. So he sought to find the hand of God in science, which seems like a laudable goal, but that's also been criticized, as you briefly touched on there, as sort of possibly creating what's called the God of the gaps. So I want you to expand a little bit more on why that might be a problematic way to look at science.
Okay, so, and this is really important because it's fairly widely misunderstood, and I think pinning this down is fairly important. So for a long time, in fact, for most of our recorded history, the God was used as an explanatory force for the way things happened in the world. And if you go back anciently, you see a much more hands-on God. Why, you know, questions like, why did my crops fail? Why did I lose this battle? Can be answered by, I didn't provide the right sacrifices. God was used much more as an explanation for things that happened in the natural world. And as time progresses, that becomes less and less so. And you get to Paley, and he's buying into the argument that if we look at nature, that we can learn things about God. And so he looks at things like the eye and other things, and he makes claims about what we learn about God. We learn that God is rational, that God is involved in beauty and things like this. It's a very selective reading of nature, though. He's not looking at sort of the horrors of nature.
Right. Red in tooth and claw is that phrase. And I think that's what Darwin was pointing at too as well. He thought about there's a certain insect or something that plants its eggs inside of another insect, and it's very...
Yeah, an ichneumonid wasp.
Yeah.
It really troubled Darwin. You know, why if God is good, is nature, if you look at it closely, a very horrific process? Lots of bad things are going on. I just was watching a nature documentary that showed a lion that had been kicked in the jaw by a wildebeest, and its jaw is just hanging loose. It's starving to death. It lasts for days and days and days, unbelievable suffering. And that kind of thing is avoided by Paley, who Darwin very, very carefully read. The thing is though, as God was used as an explanation, as people came to understand the world better, then the explanation moved away from God. Oh, we understand now that you know, the sun is not held in position by spheres that God's designed. It's much more natural. So the role of God begins to retreat in the history of human thought. And so Pali sort of provided this bulwark that nobody really understood. How do things in nature change? How do species arise? And it was a huge role for God. And this is where I think some of the biggest conflicts between science and religion emerged, was we see Darwin suddenly provides an explanation for what was held as, just incredible evidence for how God acts in the world. And so God retreated that much more. So the God of the gaps viewpoint is really an idea where people use God to explain things. So God has explanatory power for the way things happen in the natural world. And as those explanations become clearer through science, we understand the way that the causal forces work together, then God is no longer necessary for that argument, and he retreats. And so the God of the gaps argument then becomes that, well, look, in history, people needed God and to explain this, 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 and this. And as time has gone on, God's role has decreased and decreased and decreased. And so people like the evangelical atheists glom onto that, and they say, let's just do the regression analysis and see where this thing's trending. God's role is getting smaller and smaller. If you look into the future, it's just going to disappear. And so the God of the gaps arguments are those that push God into this explanatory role in explaining natural scientific phenomenon, and that role is retreated. And so they claim, well, the gap's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and we can just extrapolate into the future and say the role of God is going to completely disappear. So let's make it happen.
Now, on the flip side of that, some people would criticize certain scientists or particular claims that science makes as overreaching what the evidence that they have so far. And they would point out that because science has been wrong in the past, wrong in the sense of we now view things differently, why should we put so much trust in it now? So they would point to, we used to believe that the Earth was the center of the universe, and now we, see that. So they would say, well, look, they've been wrong in the past, so how can we put so much stock in science today? Do we put too much stock in science today? What would you say about that?
Actually, I actually find that kind of fun. I'd say humorous, but I'll back off of that. Because if they look, they're who cleaned up the messes in the past? Who realigned, the heliocentric universe? Who came to push back the old ideas that turned out not to be true? It was science. It was science itself that is always self-critiquing and self-correcting, and that's one of its strengths, is that it doesn't allow these things. If there are better explanations, better theories, all of these things, it pushes it aside. And it's not been anything but science that's given us the advances. And so when people claim, and I hear this argument a lot, that science has been wrong, so it can't be trusted, it's always changing its mind, not recognizing, holy cow, that's what makes it so strong. It does change its mind in light of further analysis, in new analyses, in new data. It has to take the stories that it's told before, look at them in light of new data, and change its mind. And
No,
so,
you're such a flip. You're a flip-flopper, Steve.
I know, I am. That's the thing about science. You just have to keep changing your mind.
That's
And I've
interesting.
actually been in some scientific battles that I was wrong about in retrospect, and I had to reformulate my views. And so, science, and scientists in particular, they have their biases, they have their agendas, but it comes down to what does the data say? And if the data says differently, we have to go with that. Now, admittedly, that's a very complex process. Whenever you get new data, new interpretations, you have to ask questions like, well, is it the data or is it the method? Do we have new instrumentation? Are the instruments right? In the current issue of Evolution, in fact, there's a big debate about methods that are used to build these trees of life using DNA, about which one's most important. So you have these methodological battles, you have these data gathering battles. So it's complex, but science will straighten it out. I mean, you can't help but look at that science has made progress over time. You look at a science, let me put quotes around that, like astrology. And you know, the predictions made this year aren't much better than they were made in 1870.
Right.
That's the sign of a depauperate scientific program. Science, if it's not advancing, isn't an active, it's not an active research program that's doing what science should do.
There seems to be an interesting dialectic in a lot of scientific endeavors then between needing confidence and also requiring humility, and that seems to be an interesting tension that exists there.
And the way that plays out a lot of times, and this is one of the things about science I think that's really important for people to realize, is that tension often exists in the population of scientists. There are people that will hold on to theories, because they're heavily invested in it, just like anybody, and people who aren't. And so a lot of times the tension is between different research programs that have differences of opinions, and when they come to agree on a consensus, and when all the scientists are sort of converging on the same story, that's a real sign of strength. For example, continental drift, completely uncontroversial now. Everybody has a good, clear picture of how the continents move across the surface of the Earth. They have mechanisms now that we understand how that happens and why and how fast. We have good geological records. But when it was first proposed, geologists didn't have a mechanism. It sounded like nonsense. And a large group of people denied that for a long, long time, that this was even possible. And so there was a tension, and it wasn't until more data was gathered and people began to see that there were mechanisms that could cause this kind of floating continent idea. And that's the science progresses. It's, there are people that'll hold on to the old ways, people who are promoting things. And what wins really is this Darwinian battle between what the data starts to show, how you gather data, and these kinds of things.
Now, what seems interesting to me is in that process, some people want to pit the idea of faith against the idea of reason and observation. So it seems to me like that science itself is also a certain kind of exercise of faith. There is a room in science for an idea of faith. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. In fact, there is faith in the process itself. For example, I just use this example about continental drift. Have I ever analyzed any continental drift data? No. Have I ever done a deep sea core to look at the spreading rate between spreading zones and between the continents? No. And so, why do I speak so confidently about continental drift? Because I trust the process in a sense, and that is a kind of faith. I have faith that I'm not being misled, that I'm not the people involved, that there's a population of people who are concerned with finding out the truth about nature, and that if there are problems, they get exposed. I mean, scientific fraud typically gets exposed at some point. There's strong motivation in science, and this is where science really looks Darwinian, to get ahead of your neighbor. I mean, it's not a conspiracy. I laugh when I hear people have a conspiracy, because scientific programs are constantly at war with each other because there's limited resources in funding. And if you can get funding over and above somebody else, if you can show they're wrong, you can build a career on destroying people. And so if your data is bad, if your analyses are poor, people jump on that in a second and try to bring you down. It's very, very bloodthirsty and contentious. At not in a personal, we all go to meetings and get along, but if you think you have a better idea than somebody, you're not going to be nice about saying you're wrong. So
Now, I guess the flip side of that too is you're not going to overemphasize the areas of where your particular theory or your particular experiment at the time might lapse as well, and that would be what other people in the scientific community would then play the role of doing as devil's advocating. Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, and it usually happens sort of for benign reasons, like you really like this theory and it makes sense to you, and so you promote it. And then people looking over your shoulder can correct you. I just got some papers back from peer review, and they really destroyed me in one area, and probably so. I really could clarify my thinking, and there they pointed out some papers that I'd missed that maybe I want to take into account, and that kind of thing is why science, I think, really is progressive and really does move forward, and that mistakes are corrected, and it gets better and better.
Okay, I was recently reading a book that pointed out two of the biggest focuses in science and religion in dialogue today are physics and biology. And the article pointed out that biology seems to pose a bigger threat. That's why we see scientists like Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins who try to draw on biology or sociobiology to combat religious faith. And I was wondering what you thought about that claim about physics and biology being the two biggies right now as far as religion's concerned.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the reason is because both are trying to explicate creative processes. And religion has a big investment in creation. I mean, it's one of the things that God did. And so to the extent that there is a conflict, and you brought up Dennett and Dawkins. The interesting thing about Dennett and Dawkins and some of the creationist views is they both draw on the same world picture for looking at creation, and that's that God did it in a certain way, and that if you make claims that God's creation was, say, 6,000 years ago, then there are matters of fact that Dawkins and Dennett bring into bear to say that's silly. We've got evidence for millions of years of evolution here. And so the conflict kind of rests on the way that creation is explained, about how much people think they understand about the physics and the biology of creation. And to the extent that science is making claims about those processes, there's conflict. If you really are going to claim that there's a thing called natural kinds that are unbreachable, then science is saying no, that's not true. There's conflict. So a lot of the conflicts come from people have inherited in their various religions a particular way that God does creation. And I think the healthier way is to let the book of nature tell us some of that how, without releasing the claims about who did it and why.
It's interesting that you point to bring up the book of nature again, because I was actually on my mission. I remember being very tied to the idea that the earth was 6,000 years old and that evolution was somehow a nefarious doctrine, or that there wasn't truth to the idea of evolution. And I had conversations with various mission companions, one of which who attended school at BYU, and he had learned about biology or about evolution at BYU. And I thought that was very shocking. I had a hard time believing that. But later in my mission, I remembered that I also began reading Henry Eyring's book, the book that he wrote, the sort of memoir that he wrote. And he talked about the book of nature and how he drew on geology and other things to come to the conclusion that the earth was older than assumptions that we make about the scriptures and things like that. So I sort of made a shift in the way that I viewed things. And like you said, the problems that I encountered really rested on the assumptions that I was making. Okay. So I sort of adjusted those assumptions, and I could better account for the book of nature, like you said.
Right, right. And I think that's right. I think that the problems come because people are holding on to particular stories or ways of viewing the creation that are in conflict with science. But I don't think that the views that they're holding on to are necessary. And that we can let science inform us about the way that life has evolved on Earth, and the way that physics and planetary science tells us about the nature of the universe.
And that's a good segue to the next topic, which is specifically evolution. And So I'm excited to talk to you about this one particularly. So evolution is a way to understand the development of life on Earth, I guess, would be a very shorthanded way of saying it. Maybe you can give us some of the basics as far as what we mean when we talk about evolution.
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. But
and try to fit it within 10 seconds,
okay.
If you could.
No. Evolution.
No.
Evolution is really three things. All it takes for evolution with natural selection is variation in traits, selection on that different traits, meaning that one is going to have more offspring than the other for reasons of having traits that fit whatever particular environment you're in that's better. And the other is that these traits are inherited. So three ideas: variation, selection, and inheritance. Really,
so you'd say like variation. So Darwin talked about the birds' beaks. So it'd
right.
be like variations in size of beaks compared to what food they would have,
right?
And then whether or not they pass that trait on to offspring, sort of a thing.
Exactly. So birds who happen to have a little bit longer beak that gets them a few more nuts, gives them a little more energy reserve, do better than beaks with a shorter. They have more offspring. If that beak size is inherited, the offspring are going to have more advantage, and then it's a runaway process. And the interesting thing is you see this not just in biology, but you see it in chemical systems, you see it in computer, you can see this in computer digital organisms. It always holds. So if you have these three attributes, evolution occurs. The real argument, if you want to make an argument that life on Earth doesn't evolve, you're making the claim that one of those three things don't hold in natural systems. And that's a hard argument to make, because everything we see in nature suggests that it is one of these kinds of systems.
Now, when you're looking at evolution, you embrace what's called methodological naturalism.
Right.
I want you to describe what that is and methodological naturalism.
You know, I think this is probably one of the most understood concepts around, because I'm often get thrown, oh, science is this atheistic problem, you know, or these silly ideas like we need to bring God into science, not God into the scientists, but God into science. And I really don't know what that would mean, because methodological materialism is the fundamental assumption of science, but it doesn't say anything about whether there's a God. Now, some people take methodological naturalism, like Dennett and Dawkins, and create a ontological naturalism, meaning that the kinds of forces that we study in science are the only kind of forces in the universe, or the only kind of thing that exists in the universe, and that's a leap of faith. I mean, the idea that science actually is studying only the things that there are seems like a huge leap, and it is a leap, and it's jumping over a huge epistemological gap. But methodological materialism is completely non-threatening, because you do it every day. I mean, every time.
And what is it, basically? It's just that you're agreeing to focus on what can be empirically, or what you can identify using the senses, and you're just agreeing to stick to that as what you're studying? Is that the
idea?
Yeah,
it really just means that there are no hidden forces, meaning not maybe hidden in the sense of we don't understand them yet, but there's no influence from God, angels, demons, no magic, no miracles.
In the lab,
right,
like when you're analyzing the data.
This doesn't
right?
mean that scientists don't believe in God or miracles, or that science claims that nothing doesn't fit into the materialist claims. What it means is, or that science will even reveal all truth, but what it means are these are the only kinds of things we can study. And so a good example is we're all essentially methodological materialists when it comes to car repair. Okay, you were mentioning you may have a thermostat problem in your car, and if
that's right,
if you take it to the mechanic, what you're assuming that the problem is probably based on something that has to do with metalish things, lubricants, gadgets, you know, the kinds of things that go wrong within an engine. You're not assuming that there's some strange force or malicious fairies at work. You know, you wouldn't take your car to get your thermostat fixed to someone who exercised bad luck from it, you know. And so you are in fact a methodological materialist when it comes to car repair, because you think whatever's wrong has causes, material causes, that something's worn out, that something doesn't work right, and you assume that those material causes can be interfered with to correct the problem. So methodological materialism is not a threat to faith. It's not a threat to religion. And it's what you do every day when you go look for a problem that you assume rests in the material world somewhere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's basically a decision to focus on certain things,
right,
you know, in the lab sort of a thing. It's not disclaiming the existence of God or even denying that God could be involved in the process. It's just saying, this is what we have to work with. This is what we can identify,
right,
sort of a thing.
Right. So,
okay.
So somebody claims we need to put back in God in science. You know, what would it mean to say we need to put God back in mechanics? We need, you know,
right.
You know, no, important point. I mean, because mechanics can be any religion. They can be a good Mormon, a good atheist, a good Buddhist, whatever, and still be a great
right.
mechanic. You know, and you can be a great scientist and be very, very religious. So I get disturbed that people find methodological materialism so threatening. And I also get disturbed that people take methodological materialism and turn it into an ontological materialism, like, you know, the evangelical atheists.
A lot of the new atheists
right.
do that too. So, right? I mean, you've got evangelical fundamentalists, I would say, because there are many evangelicals who
right.
don't do that, but fundamentalists, and then also new atheists who
exactly.
share that same assumption, which is
right.
sort of ironic.
It is. It's amazing how much those two groups agree.
Now, what sort of evidence for evolution? Some people would say, well, you know, I don't see a half monkey man
right.
walking around out there. So what sort of evidence are we drawing on to say that evolution occurs?
You know, people don't realize this. It's one of the most strong, there's more evidence for evolution, for example, that there is that the sun's made of hydrogen. And the interesting thing about the evidence from evolution is it's coming from multiple sources. So it's coming from the fossil record. That alone convinced everybody in the 18th century that evolution occurred. You know, Darwin's mechanism went up and down, but the fact that species have changed is very, very clear. But now we have DNA evidence. We have evidence of, they call it homology, the idea that, you know, the way that bodies are built. So we have genetic, we have fossil, we have, now add that, we have lots and lots of experimental evidence from things that evolve rapidly enough to see it in real time. For example, in what I work with in insect resistance, you see genetic changes that happen rapidly enough to be caught. And bacteria is easy as pie. We've got some really, really strong evidence, but also modeling evidence, the way that we can build models that show mathematically how things change, how quickly and things. And so typically when a science is bad, what happens is as you begin to accumulate evidence, the evidence either, you know, will start to suggest that something's wrong. You start to fill it with anomalies. Evolutionary biology is a active and strong research program, and it's and with literally thousands of people on the ground studying everything from the way DNA evolves, looking at sort of these DNA fossils, the way that DNA, you know, you can learn a lot about the past history of organisms with DNA, but the way things are changing on the ground, there's some, in fact, interesting work by Jack Seitz at BYU is looking at lizards evolve. He sees the changes right in real time. He's been studying it for 30 years. And it's everywhere. Everywhere you look, you see the evidence for evolution, and it's amazingly strong. Now, the reason you don't see like monkey men walking on the ground is that we didn't evolve from chimps. Chimps and humans evolved from a common ancestor. So it was a very different thing on the earth than what we have today. And that's I think a misconfusion for a lot of people is, you know, if humans evolved from apes, why do we still have apes? Well, it's a branching process, and the kinds of things that lived here, you know, 4 or 5 million years ago are completely different from the things that live here now. We see their fossils, and we gather data about their bones, and it's absolutely clear.
That's really fascinating to think about Darwin. I mean, when he first put out his works, there we didn't have the idea of genes even yet, right? I mean, science hadn't even advanced that far.
Right.
So it sounds like, to put it in a scriptural parlance, you'd say, out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. And you're saying with evolution, we have many different witnesses from many different scientific fields that converge on that same, same theory.
It's as absolutely strong a research program as you will find anywhere in any science. I'll even go so far as to say, if you don't believe the evolutionary story from the evidence and the analyses that have been done, you really don't believe in science. You are abandoning the idea of science to hold on to anti-evolutionary beliefs.
Now, here's what people will point to when you say something like that, is that they'll say that evolution is a theory, they'll say, and they'll also point out that there are still some questions being worked out. So there's a way to try to undercut the idea of evolution by pointing to anomalies or puzzles that still exist. What would your response
be to
that? Well,
you know, in some ways, I'll say they're right. I mean, I'll say that science has to be open to that possibility, that there is some higher thing that it could explain all the data, and you know, would completely overturn everything we know. Right now, that's hard to imagine, and in fact, Science in its approach to truth can't really ever get there. It always has to be open to the possibility. But science tells us how to bet. And that's the way to think about science, is science sort of aligns the probabilities. To bet against evolution, you're betting, you know, odds 1,000,000 to 1, in fact. Now, you know, there's still that you know, 1/1,000,000th of a chance that it may be wrong. But it's such an active research program. There's so much going on. There are probably on the order of, I would guess, just offhand, I'll say easily 100 journals in evolution. I think it's much, much more, but I'm being really conservative here. And they publish about 25 papers a month. And all of these are people who are expanding the story. They're refining it. They're making so. The story of evolution itself is a very, very solid story, but there's a lot on the branches that needs to be worked out. I'm just glancing right now at the current issue of evolution. You have papers like genetic variation and DNA replication timing, or why is there late replicating DNA? Trying to solve problems like this, you know, the fitness consequences of larval traits, you know, optimal life history strategies, and seasonal consumer resource dynamics. I mean, evolutionary biology is, I think sometimes in talking to people, you know, like on my blog and other places where people are talking about evolution, they seem to think that we're sort of sitting around in armchairs, still, you know, making the kind of arguments that are very, very simple, like here's a color spot on a moth that shows that they're not as prevalent as they were years ago when there was an industrial blanket of coal dust. But these studies are sophisticated. They're well supported there. I mean, it's an amazingly active research program, and everything we do verifies that evolution is occurring, and it is the best explanation for life on Earth, without any real scientific question about that.
And what do they hope to do with that? I mean, all that energy, money, time. What's, you know, what are a lot of scientists that you know, or a lot of researchers that you know? What are they aiming at with all of that stuff?
I mean, really, a lot of disease medicine, cancer research, draws heavily on evolutionary theory. I mean, to set aside evolutionary theory, you would shut down much of what's being done in cancer research, antibiotic resistance. You know, all these kinds of things are really based in evolutionary science. And in fact, evolutionary science is one of the reasons we have such solid medicine and things, is because we understand that populations evolve. We understand the genetics of it. As we look more and more at DNA and the way things are evolving, there's a really nice example of they just sequenced a I'm trying to think of the organism. I saw this a couple of days ago. It was something. I think it was a dog. Yeah, it was a dog. They sequenced the entire genome of a dog. And what the nice thing about dog breeding is real clear evidence about inherited diseases. And so they were really, and this was a disease that humans and dogs share. So through this work, they were able to backtrack and see how that was inherited, how that could then be used for to screen for humans and to create treatments and things. So evolutionary biology is really at the heart of all biology. I mean, the famous biologist Dobzhansky says, you know, nothing makes sense in biology without evolution, and it's absolutely true. It's the unifying concept, and to deny it just flies in the face of all that we know about science and reason and fact. That's a bold claim, but I really stand by it.
Right, and it's a bold claim that some people believe has bearing on how Latter-day Saints should view the scriptures or how we should view science. So in the next episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about the religious angle of evolution. Join us on the next episode, and we talk about evolution and Latter-day Saint belief. So join us for that episode.